Hey there, listeners. Galen Druk here. House Majority Whip James Clyburn endorsed Joe Biden on Wednesday, and it's a big endorsement, particularly in the run-up to the South Carolina primary. I'm down here in South Carolina this week and met up with Clyburn ahead of his endorsement to discuss how he arrived at his decision and also how he's viewing this primary generally. Take a listen. Congressman, thank you so much for taking the time today. So here in South Carolina, you are known as a kingmaker. And in 538's endorsement tracker, your endorsement is worth the most points possible. So what do you think your endorsement means here in South Carolina?
Well, I don't know what it means. I know what I want it to mean.
What do you want it to mean?
You know, I made clear to the Democratic National Committee that if they were to select South Carolina as one of the so-called pre-primary window states, that I would not do anything to undercut the primary in any way or to short-circuit it. And they felt that if I were to get out with an early endorsement, that other candidates might not come. And then CBS, who is co-sponsoring the debate with the Congressional Black Caucus Institute, also expressed the same concern. So I decided that I would not endorse until last Friday. My accountant passed away, and I went to his funeral. And when I got there, there were four or five people. I got there about 30 minutes early, and four or five people came up to me, all of them saying one thing. We would like to hear from you, or we're waiting to hear from you. There's a bunch of candidates. We don't know who's best. Who do you think is best? And I was smiling and ducking and weaving. And finally, an elderly African-American woman looked up at me, and I looked at her. And she kind of beckoned me to come over to her. And I walked over to her. She was there on the front row of the church. And she leaned down here. And she whispered to me. She says, I've been waiting to hear from you. A lot of people want to hear from you. Just whisper in my ear who I should vote for.
Did you tell her?
Yes, I did.
And so according to multiple sources, reports say that you plan on endorsing Joe Biden on Wednesday morning. Are those reports correct?
I've read that.
You've read that?
I read those reports. Yeah, I've read those reports.
And are they correct?
I'm not going to pass on that just yet. I've made it very clear that I will make my views known at 9:15 on Wednesday morning.
And do you think that people will follow your lead? And perhaps more to the point, do you think they should follow your lead when you do make your endorsement known?
Let me just say I am hopeful that they will. I spent pretty much all of my life studying South Carolina politics. I've been in Congress now for 28 years. I'm a student of history. I studied trends. And I see developing in this primary much of what I saw back in 1972. Now, most people who are involved out now passing judgment on everything, they don't remember back to 1972, but I do. And it's eerie, similar.
And you're talking about George McGovern.
George
and
McGovern.
A particularly liberal coalition that he
That's
built
exactly
up
right.
during the primary.
Absolutely. Almost the same as it is now. I remember that so well. In 1972, Miami Convention, us Southerners, we're over in one camp, and I'm talking about Southern, I'm talking about throughout the South, those states, so much so, and we were being run over by others. In fact, Jesse Jackson Jr., who's Jesse Jackson Sr., who is from South Carolina, I played athletics against him when we were growing up. He is big in the George McGovern camp. Imaru Baraka, Leroy Jones, big. They were just, and we are sitting there saying, wait a minute, the country is not going to go that way. This country is not ready to go that way. But they won.
Relating that to today, are you essentially saying that you hope to stop Senator Sanders from winning the nomination because you see him building too much of a liberal coalition to win a general election?
I'm not trying to stop him. I'm saying to people what I think we need and who I think we need. I'm not trying to stop anybody.
Yeah.
I'm just trying to inform.
I'm curious. So at 538, we spend a lot of time tracking public opinion, trying to figure out what the will of the people actually is. And we rely a lot on polls. How do you come to a conclusion about what or who is best for South Carolina?
I go to church, and I should say churches. I go to social places. I go to restaurants. I go to lounges. And I talk mostly to the people in motels and hotels who are cleaning the furniture, sweeping the floors. Those are the people I talk to. I've had one media person since we've been here to ask me in the motel I'm staying over in the Marriott. He says, everybody, all the people working know you. I said, yeah, they know me. And I know them. And I think that's important. You know, I hang out with all the uppity-mucks, but I really spend a lot of time gathering people's feelings, knowing what they say. When I up in the State House, up in the United States Capitol, I the most meaningful article ever written about me, I think, was, I don't remember whether it was a roll call or what, one of the organs on the Hill wrote a story, and they had a picture of the people who moved the moving the furniture and all that stuff around there. And they were talking about who, which congressman they most respected and felt comfortable with. And I was selected because I never overlook. They are over 18. They are raising children, grandchildren. These are people who really have aspirations, and I talk to them.
So that's how you come to a conclusion about what's best for South Carolina.
Yeah.
So what is best for South Carolina? What does the state need from a nominee or a president?
We need a nominee who will do three things. Explain to people what your candidacy means to them. Say to them, this is what my election means to you. This is what my election means to your family. And this is what my election means to your community. And I've said to every one of the candidates who've asked, talk to people about what's in it for them. Let them know what their families can get from there. Let them know what you will do to improve their communities. And so I tend to do everything under those three headings. Make this country's greatness accessible and full. I put up billboards around in hope that it would be a suggestion to all the people coming. Now, I've been saying, this country does not to be made, need to be made great. It is great. The problem we've got is making that greatness accessible and affordable for all. When we talk about healthcare, nobody needs to know the ins and outs of healthcare. They need to know how this healthcare system can be accessible and affordable for them. They need to know whether or not our energy sources will be accessible and affordable to them. When you're talking about infrastructure, is it broadband you're talking about, or who gets another road or bridge? You know, is it energy you're talking about? That is what we've got to do. And if you make this housing and healthcare, broadband, energy, you name it, education, make it accessible and affordable, I think that's how you connect to people. Our problem, it seems to me, is too many candidates spend time trying to let people know how smart they are. Rather than trying to connect with people.
Are you referring to anybody in particular?
No, not anybody in particular. I've been arguing with my caucus about this for a long time. Let me give you one good example. what it means to you when a candidate say you need to be able to send your kids to college. Now, how many times have you heard that? I hate to hear that.
Yeah.
And I tell my caucus, I don't need to hear that, because we got people who want to be electricians, they want to be plumbers, they want to be a lot of things, barbers. You know, my barber has both of his sons in the barbershop with him. That's what they want to do.
So to that point, South Carolina has one of the lowest median incomes in the country.
Absolutely.
Bernie Sanders spends a lot of time talking about the structural challenges for poor people in America. Mm-hmm. But you've made it clear that you're not interested in a democratic socialist. Why don't you think that's the right prescription, given how much of a focus there is in his platform on the poor?
There's a big difference to me between rhetoric and reality. I'm 79 years old. I'm older than Bernie. You know, indeed. And I've had experiences he has not had. I am not a millionaire. You know, I've raised three children. And I'm now helping to raise four grandchildren. So I don't want to hear a lot of rhetoric. I want to know what's real. And it's not real that child care is going to be free for everybody. At what age? 5 years old, 4 years old, 3 or 2? When do you make child care free? When do you make education free? It's not realistic that you're going to eliminate all student debt. What is realistic is to lay out some programs as to how education is going to be affordable. Child care is going to be affordable. My grandson, 25 years old, who is on the staff of Mayor Pete, all he's ever said to me, I don't want it to be free. I would love to afford it. And that's what it's all about. People want to earn their keep. They don't, there may be some people, but as a rule, people don't want you to give them anything. We want you to remove the stumbling blocks so it'll be accessible for me. Move all of the areas that would make it unaffordable. That's what people want.
South Carolina is something of an existential test for former Vice President Joe Biden's campaign, which he's staked in large part on his appeal to voters of color. Being on the ground here in South Carolina, close to the action, how do you think he'll perform?
Well, if the election were held today, it won't be until Saturday. If it were held today, I think he would finish first. How first, I don't know. I think that if Amy Klobuchar had the resources, she would do very well here.
Why Amy Klobuchar in particular?
Because I know South Carolinians, and I know what appeals to South Carolinians. And she has a message that appeals, she has a style that appeals to South Carolinians. And I also know that, you know, people tell me, well, you know, young people this and young people that. Well, the fact of the matter is, Bernie is one of the oldest people out there, and a lot of young people, most of the young people, seem to be voting for him. So, you know, and I've said that to Mayor Pete. Age ain't going to make a big difference. If you're 37 or 38 years old, people say, that, well, the young people going to vote for you. That ain't what's happening. And so that's why I think the rhetoric is one thing. You know, South Carolinians have reset these primaries many times on both sides of the aisle. When Bill Clinton got to South Carolina, he lost by 8 or 9, maybe 10 contests before he got to South Carolina. But he got his campaign reset here. Hillary Clinton had just lost New Hampshire to Bernie Sanders. South Carolina, she got over 80% of the black vote in South Carolina after losing in New Hampshire.
I want to ask you about that specifically. So no Democrat has won the party's nomination without winning the majority of black support since 1992. And in the past two contests in particular, you've seen the black vote arguably be decisive in large part because it's unified, right? Clinton won about 80% in the primary. Obama won about 80% in the primary. This year, it looks like the black vote in South Carolina and nationally is more divided between Biden and Sanders, and then even here in South Carolina, Steyer. Right. Are there specific things that you see that are causing divisions within the African-American community over who they want to vote for? Or is that just a byproduct of having such a deep field?
We got a broad field. 20-some-odd people were running. We had three African-Americans in the contest. There's just a big, wide, broad, diverse field. And there's more money being spent in this primary than ever before. When have we ever had two billionaires running in a Democratic primary for anything?
Yeah.
And so when you've got money to spend and you spend it, you are going to be very influential in advertising your message, especially when you're drawing out others. You cannot tell me that there are more black people in South Carolina with sentiments toward Cory Booker and Kamala Harris than there are toward Steyer. So why is it that Steyer is pulling 14-15% in African-American community and Cory and Kamala are gone from the contest? It's all about the money. I have said, and I believe this very strongly, that the Citizens United decision on the part of the United States Supreme Court was the worst Supreme Court decision since Dred Scott. I have said that, and I believe that very strongly. When you make money speech, and that's what that speech did, you are saying that the person with the most money got the most speech. And if you've got an African-American community that ain't making as much money as white people, you are saying white people got more speech than black people. That is a bad, bad decision. And this country is going to wake up one day, and if we don't get rid of that decision, and find out that that's what brought the country down.
You mentioned that Harris and Booker are now out of the race. And from a historically diverse field, it's been winnowed to what's remaining are white candidates.
Right.
Do you think that white politicians are able to fully represent the interests of black Americans?
It all depends upon the experiences these candidates have. I have said my biography, which I wrote, and by the way, the readers of Amazon gives it 5 stars, so it ain't a joke book. I called it Blessed Experiences. And I say in that book that all my experiences have not been pleasant, but I've considered all of them to be blessings. And it's which candidate has been blessed with the most meaningful experiences that they can share. And I believe that that is what makes the candidate in the black community.
What specifically do you have to see from a white politician to make it clear that they get it? They understand what needs to be done to represent the African-American community?
If you can go to a group of people and say, here is what my candidacy means for you. Do you want to have better health care for yourselves? Do you want pre-existing conditions to be protected? Just go through the litany. Then says, what do you want for your family? Do you want to be able to educate your children? Not send them to college, but to educate them. Make them plumbers, make them electricians, if that's what their aspirations are. And here is what's in it for your family. And go in the community. You need broadband in your community. Am I willing to lay out a plan as to how we will have total coverage of broadband, because that's the way you're going to keep your rural hospitals open. That's how you're going to keep your schools functional and adequate. Broadband. What is in it for you, your family, your community? And why that's so hard, I don't understand. All of this foolishness that we're talking about. I sat down with the CBS people and I said to them, I said, look, you're all sponsoring this debate. This is South Carolina. There's no way in the world you can come to Charleston, South Carolina, directly across the street from Emmanuel Church, and do what you did, what was done out there in Nevada, where we had the worst mass shooting anywhere. And it was never, ever mentioned. Nothing about it was mentioned. You ain't going to be across the street from Emmanuel AME Church, where we had the most egregious, I think, assassination of worshipers, and not mention that. And I says, now, you're going to be in Charleston. North Charleston has the highest eviction rate in the country, according to a Princeton University study. So you can't come and not talk about housing and affordable housing. We led the nation until a few years ago in amputations because of the late detection of diabetes. My wife, recently deceased, spent 20 years fighting diabetes. At one time, was a 4-shot-a-day diabetic. So you ain't going to come to South Carolina with that kind of record, and you're going to be 6 blocks from the Medical University of South Carolina and not talk about health care. So that, to me, is whether or not we get these candidates to focus on what these people's experiences are as they live. We are but the sum total of our experiences. And the candidate that can appeal to people at their level of experiences, not up there at 35,000 feet, but go to them where they live, what they're experiencing. And if you appeal to that, you're going to do well.
You mentioned the white nationalist terrorist attack at Mother Emanuel. Mm-hmm. And the conversation, it seems like, within the Democratic Party about race has changed significantly over the past decade. I think quite famously, Obama ran a campaign that de-emphasized some of the differences between white and black America, saying, you know, there's no white America, there's no black America, there's these United States of America. Even though the field right now is white candidates, the conversation is a lot more specific about the ways that white and black America are different when it comes to health, wealth, criminal justice, all sorts of things. Reparations, for example. What do you think of how the conversation about race has changed in the Democratic Party over the past decade?
It's still just a conversation. Sure, it's changed. We're not talking about race more than we did several years ago. If you're looking at Barack Obama, he doesn't need to tell you how black he is. You're looking at him.
Yeah.
You know. So these other candidates who ain't black, they may have to address the question. But I think we need to be realistic even about reparations. The root word for reparations is repair. What do we need to do to repair? And that's what you ought to be saying about reparations. But for some strange reason, and in this campaign, the first time reparations came up, I still remember Mayor Pete struggling with that, saying he monetized it. All these candidates, they immediately start thinking how much money each person is supposed to get for reparations. Nobody ever asked for it to be monetized. Why do we keep going there? What we do ask is, how are we going to repair our faults? I prepared for a campaign 2 years ago by rereading Alexis de Tocqueville's Democracy in America. There's one little sentence in one volume of that two-volume book that said this: America's greatness is not because it is more enlightened than any other nation, but because they have always been able to repair its faults. That is what makes us great. So how do you repair the faults of slavery? Not how you monetize it, but how do you repair the faults? And if the candidates would go out for that, that's what my 10-20-30s are. But that's why you see Bernie Sanders immediately picked up on the fact. He said, when they asked him about reparations, Mayor Pete was talking about monetizing it. Bernie says, I'm going to adopt Jim Clyburn's 10-20-30 formula. That's how I'm going to address reparations.
So you say when the candidates talk about monetizing reparations, that's the wrong way of doing things. What do you think the right way of doing things is?
I just said, what programs do you have that will repair the faults of slavery? Were African Americans undereducated? South Carolina has in its constitution, and has been reaffirmed by the Supreme Court recently, that we guarantee a minimally adequate education. Is that the way you educate? That's what the concept of this is. So how do we deal with that concept of what's minimum? How do you maximize that? Not how you monetize it, but how you maximize education. How do you bring health care? Not how you pay for it, how you make it accessible. That is what we have to do. And so I just think that this thing is much more simple than people are let it be.
Looking at the analysis from the 2016 election, arguably Hillary Clinton could have won had she had gotten the kind of black turnout that President Obama got in 2008 and 2012. Now, of course, that was a historic candidacy. maybe it just was never going to be possible for Hillary Clinton. But what do you think Democrats need to do in order to try to get turnout back up to 2008, 2012 levels?
Well, do what we did in Alabama. If you remember, in the special election of Alabama with Doug Jones, and people said we couldn't win, and they said, in order to win, I'll never forget this, the black turnout in Alabama would have to be at Barack Obama's levels, and that ain't going to happen. I can't tell you how many times I've heard that. However, when they did the analysis, the black turnout was 1 point above what it was. Why? Because we engaged the African-American community. We didn't talk at them. We sent people down there and we engaged them on their levels, and they turned out for Doug Jones. We gave them a candidate that they could relate to. Doug Jones was a candidate they could relate to. Doug Jones was not running for the United States Senate when he decided that they needed to repair a fault. It was a fault for the judicial system to exonerate or to avoid prosecuting those people who killed those little four girls. And he got to be the attorney general. He went after them. He prosecuted them. He found them guilty. That endeared him to that community, and nobody was going to get between that community and him. The candidate, irrespective of what party the candidate is in, that will do those things that are necessary to make the system work. He made the judicial system work for the descendants, or the, well, descendants as well, of those, the siblings of those children. I've talked to the father. I've talked to the sisters, and I know what they're feeling. And so I said to people, let's send the resources down there. Let's lend the people down there. Doug Jones can win this election, and he won it.
So Doug Jones is perhaps an example of a white candidate who gets
absolutely
it. I'm curious, looking at Pew Research Center data, white Democrats in particular have become much more liberal over the past two decades. Now a majority of white Democrats identify as liberal. That's not the case for black and Hispanic Democrats.
Absolutely.
That number is closer to 30%. And I think the Trump campaign sees some of that and says, you know what, we're going to go after voters of color for whom the Democratic Party may be too liberal. Are you worried at all about that divide that exists now between maybe white liberals and more conservative voters of color in the party?
Yes, I am. And that's what I'm talking about when I'm saying reality versus rhetoric. All this liberalism, that's a bunch of rhetoric. Just look at, we regained the House this time. Why? Not because four progressives defeated four progressives. We didn't pick up a single thing in those four races that everybody talked about. AOC is fine. She beat another Democrat. You know, I love Ilhan Omar. She's fine. She replaced another black Democrat. If you go down through it, but all of a sudden, we got these other people winning seats. Lauren Underwood, she wins a seat against an incumbent Republican in a district that's 4% African American. Those are the people that flipped the House. And so when you got all these people with all this liberal rhetoric, it doesn't mean a thing in these districts that we won.
You are House Majority Whip. Party unity is your job in
yes.
part. What do you do facing those kinds of divisions in the party? I mean, you mentioned AOC, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. She said that in any other country, she and Joe Biden would not even be in the same party. So facing the nomination and just a general election coming down the pike, what do you think leadership or progressives need to do in order to work out their differences?
I don't think there are any differences. That's what I keep saying. We need to direct our attention to what we can do for people who are trying to participate in this process. What we need to do for them, their families, and their communities. That's where we need to focus our attention. And I think that's where we're making a big mistake. You know, people ask all the time, how do you get such strong support from the banking community? How do you get such strong support from the chambers of commerce? I get support from the National Chamber of Commerce. I have never sacrificed my principles one time. Never. And you look at my voting record, I don't have a voting record that any so-called liberal would be embarrassed with. You hold on to your principles, but you make sure that you make programs work for people. So I don't talk about reparations as a thing. I talk about how we repair faults. That's what 1023 is all about. That's what my student reducing student loan debt. I didn't go out and say, I'm going to eliminate student loan debt. We just got the candidate says, I'm going to eliminate your student loan debt. I'm going to give you free child care. I'm going to give you free college education. Come on.
So you clearly disagree with that way of campaigning or appealing
Absolutely.
To the public. Is there any aspect of what progressives are arguing that you think is right, that you say you have a point, we can learn from you?
I'm a progressive.
I guess, okay, so perhaps the more liberal parts of the party that we've been discussing.
Be practical.
But I mean, is there any part of their appeal to the public that you think is correct, that you say, okay, we can learn from you, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez or Bernie Sanders, and take a page out of your book?
Absolutely. I believe in everybody having access to health care. So I don't have a problem with the goal. The problem is, how do we get there? I believe in everybody having access to affordable housing. How do we get there? That's where I disagree. I don't disagree with the goal. I disagree with the approaches. And you are not going to do in South Carolina, Georgia, Florida, Mississippi, Alabama, Texas. The approaches got to be different. How does Colin Allred defeat the immediate past chair of the Republican National Committee? How does he defeat it in a district that ain't near and about to be black? He did it by appealing to people's basics.
Do you think that if Bernie Sanders wins the nomination, that the Democratic Party will lose the general election in the fall?
I think it would be very, very hard for us to win. We don't have to lose. If he's right, and remember now, he keeps saying that if I'm the nominee, I'm going to turn out all these new voters. He's saying that because he knows what's going to be required. If he turns them out, he wins. If he doesn't, we lose. All I'm saying is George McGovern didn't bring new voters, and we carried only one state.
Just wrapping up here, I know your endorsement is forthcoming. Have you ever endorsed someone and later regretted giving out that endorsement?
Yes.
Who?
Not an elected official. Not an elected official. I regret feeling that Clarence Thomas would get in touch with his roots when he got to be a Supreme Court Justice. I will go to my grave regretting ever having a kind word to say about his candidacy for the United States Supreme Court. I just didn't think anybody could have that much self-hate.
All right. Well, thank you, sir. Thanks so much for taking time today.
All right.